Welcome to the Table Podcast, where we discuss issues of God and culture, brought to you by Dallas Theological Seminary.
Welcome to the Table. We discuss issues of God and culture. I'm Daryl Bach, Executive Director of Cultural Engagement at the Hendricks Center. And our topic today is giftedness, and my guest is Bill Hendricks, who is Executive Director for Christian Leadership at the Hendricks Center. So you've got the whole Hendricks Center team today, Bill. Well, we're pleased to have you with us.
It's great to be here.
And our topic is giftedness, and most people will think that what that might mean is, oh, we're going to talk about spiritual gifts and 1 Corinthians and that kind of thing. But my guess is that that's sort of right and sort of not right. So sort us out.
Well, let's just start with the fact that whatever gifts we have are always from God. And I personally wince when I hear people talk about spiritual gifts and natural gifts, because that somehow creates kind of a hierarchy mm-hmm. in people's minds. And at the end of the day, I think we're talking about all the same stuff, mm-hmm. that God has endowed human beings with actual abilities and strengths and motivations to accomplish things that he wants done. And every single person in the world has their own unique form of giftedness.
But it would be fair to say that when we talk about giftedness, we may be in a broader array of categories than people tend to think about when they think about the topic of spiritual gifts
Correct.
In the Bible.
Correct.
Yeah.
You know, in the passages in the New Testament, we have these lists of gifts, mm-hmm. and none of these lists is identical, which should be our first clue that these lists are not exhaustive. They're suggestive. Mm-hmm. It's as if Paul's saying, you know, we have a lot of kind of people in this church. Mm-hmm. We have some teachers, we have some leaders, we have some administrators, we have some givers, and then there's this catch-all, you know, for everybody else. And man, we have just a lot of people that love to help. Mm-hmm. Well, you still have to look inside an individual person to figure out how did they go about exercising the gift of administration. And so when I use the term giftedness, I'm using it in a somewhat technical way. And I guess the simple definition that I'd give is that giftedness is a set of unique core strengths and natural motivation that you instinctively use to do things that you find satisfying and productive. You know, it's not just about what you can do. It's about what you're born to do and what you, frankly, love to do.
Well, that's an interesting way to think about it. I think most people just kind of go through life and kind of try and find what works, if I can say it that way. There's not much purpose or reflection.
A lot of trial and error.
Yep.
And therefore, a lot of breakdown because people don't instinctively know what their gifts are, which sounds counterintuitive. Bill, you're saying if God made me this way, shouldn't I just know what I'm supposed to do? And the answer is, well, actually not, because your giftedness is so natural and instinctive that when you're using it, you don't think about using it. You just use it. And it doesn't seem remarkable. And you're liable to say, well, anybody could do that. And you see other people using their gifts and you think, oh my gosh, that's amazing. But you don't see yourself using your gifts. And unless somebody from the outside holds up a mirror and says, well, here's what you're doing, and celebrates it and says, here's the value of what you're doing, it proves a bit elusive.
Okay, well, that's kind of a little bit of an introduction. Why don't you tell us about the book that you've recently written and how in the world did you end up in the world of giftedness?
All right, well, first of all, the book is called The Person Called You, Why You're Here, Why You Matter, and What You Should Do With Your Life, which is a fairly audacious title, I admit.
Yeah, did they get that on the back spine?
Okay, so I'm at age 30, and my wife comes to me one day and says, okay, enough. I've put you through enough schooling, because she'd already put me through a couple master's degrees. She said, I want to stay home and have babies. You get out there and make some money. And so, you know, in politics, they call that calling the question. Uh-huh. You know, I had to make a decision. But the problem
sounds like calling the marriage to me.
Exactly. The problem is I didn't know what I wanted to do. Uh-huh. And people are saying to me, oh, Bill, but you're so bright. You went to Harvard. You got a couple master's degrees. You do anything you want. And I'm like, well, that may be, but I don't know what I want to do. And it was about that time that somebody introduced me to a fellow who he said he's got this really unique way of helping you think through that career issue. And I was very skeptical because when I was in Boston, I went through about a three and a half day workup, psychological profiles, personality inventories, interest inventories. I even did a Rorschach ink block test.
It's a spiritual MRI.
Well, I call it the psychological equivalent of a proctology exam. You know? I mean, they poked and prodded. And at the end of it, I had a big stack of reports, and I'm sure they were all true and accurate. I still know what to do with my life. But because of who it was that was recommending that I do this, I at least said I'd meet the guy. And so I met him out at DFW Airport. In those days, you could do that at the Admiral's Club. And he kind of sketched out the process that he was using, and it made a lot of intuitive sense. And then he asked me, well, would you like to go through it? And I think at the time it cost like $750, and I didn't have $750. He said, well, if the money part was taken care of, would you do it? And I said, well, sure. And I found out later he just he was consulting for my friend in his business. He just wrote it off into the business's fee, but it was really the best $750 that guy ever spent. Because when I got the results of this analysis, it was as if I'd been stumbling around in the pitch black room, tumbling over furniture, running into walls, and somebody just reached over and flipped on the light switch, and I suddenly went, oh my gosh, now I understand what it is I'm trying to do with my life. And I began to make choices on the basis of that ever since. And I got into a lot of communication projects, writing ventures, publishing ventures, video. And the guy who had developed this process was trying to get a book written on the subject of giftedness. And he was having trouble getting his manuscripts published. So he finally cried uncle and let me get in there and help him. And is working on that project, I just realized how taken I am with this whole phenomenon of human giftedness. And so I reinvented my consulting practice around that, and that's really what I've been doing for the last 20 years.
So you're saying that giftedness is kind of a combination of kind of what you do well and what your passions are, which I think is interesting. I imagine the passion part of this is the part that oftentimes gets stuffed or shunted to the side because people just want to land, I've got to have a job, I've got to do something. Is that common?
Well, let me put a quarter twist on that. Okay. I actually never use the word passion.
Okay.
I find that passion is a bit of a red herring, you know, because some people are what I would call passionate people.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, they're passionate about their work, they're passionate about their family, they're passionate about their faith, they're passionate about their sports teams. I mean, they're just passionate people.
Mm-hmm.
But I'd say the vast majority of people have a much narrower bandwidth emotionally.
Mm-hmm.
They don't have high highs, they don't have low lows. I've had no end of men particularly call me up and say, Bill, I need to come see you. Everybody tells me I need to, you know, follow my passion, but I don't know what I'm passionate about. Well, I believe passion is an emotional response to something that engages you. It could be high, could not. But everybody has this phenomenon of motivation,
mm-hmm.
something that drives their behavior.
Hmm.
And giftedness is really a combination of ability and motivation. You got to have both. You know, you can be motivated to sing in the opera, you know, but the problem is you don't have the ability. You know, you sing in the shower.
Don't go there with me.
And then conversely, you can have an ability that's actually quite profound and yet not have any motivation for it. But when you put those two together, you get certainly what we might call spectacular performance, and there's the person's heart is in the task because they love doing it.
There's a satisfaction.
There's a satisfaction. The telltale sign that one's giftedness is involved in an activity is that they enjoy that activity. They gain energy from it.
Mm-hmm.
And it doesn't even seem like work to them.
So tell us a little bit about what the search for giftedness might involve. Let's assume, Put on your imaginary hat. I walk in and I'm 25. Okay.
Right.
All right. So we've gone into the time machine. And and I say to you, I have no idea what I want to do with my life. What happens from that moment? How do you help the person kind of find themselves?
Well, we have to start by creating this owner's manual, as I like to call it. Mm-hmm. You know, if you're going to work on a sophisticated piece of machinery like a car or a computer, you'd consult the owner's manual first to find out, well, what was this machine designed to do? What does it do best? What does it take to get it to do that? What other pieces of equipment does it need around it to be most effective? And, of course, the warning labels, whatever you do, don't do this with this piece of equipment. That's essentially what we create for a person. And the process is interesting. It's not a test or a personality inventory. It's an interview. It's a little bit akin to a coach looking at game film from an athlete's performance in a sport and looking at the different exercises that he's doing in these different clips. And if the coach knows what they're doing, they start to see little idiosyncrasies about how this person does whatever they do. In our case, we go back in your life and we ask you to come up with activities that you've done that you've enjoyed doing and done well. Remember, enjoyment is the telltale sign that your giftedness is involved. And these are often very simple and mundane things even, like I learned to ride a bike, or my brother and I built a treehouse in the backyard when I was 7, or I took a history exam in 8th grade, and I just really got into this thing and this project. And
now, that's a strange person.
Well, that takes all kinds of make a
that's
world.
That's exactly right.
And I get the person then to tell me, okay, how did you go about doing this? Give me all the rich detail. And it's that detail, and you get about 8 stories. You've got a lot of data now to analyze, and you discover that there's actually all these dots that connect among the stories, and they form a pattern of behavior that this person comes back to again and again and again. And that pattern is very predictive in terms of career success and satisfaction. So armed with that owner's manual, I'm then in a position to say, okay, if this is what you're wired to do, if this is what you're born to do, where out here in the wide world of work are they paying people to do what you instinctively and naturally do, and frankly, you're going to do anyway? Why not get paid to do that, if possible?
Hmm.
And that begins to suggest options that they can go begin to explore.
And so I take it this is what happened with you as well, that someone sat down and took you through this kind of a process. And,
yes.
And what did you discover about yourself? I mean, what did your giftedness turn out to be?
I am what we call an impactor, which means I want to collide with people and make some kind of an impression or make some kind of a difference, send them off in a whole different direction. You know, if you think of a baseball bat colliding with a baseball and knocking it out of the park, well, that's what I love to do.
Mm-hmm.
Like, people never forget, oh my gosh, you know, I remember when Bill said this or did this or wrote this or whatever. And I've been doing that my whole life through whether it's getting up in front of people or writing books, or earlier years wrote music and so forth. This process that I've been using is a much more sophisticated way, and almost a higher level, to make a huge impact in somebody's life, because when you show them this stuff, it can literally, you know, transform the direction of their life. And I've seen that over and over and over. I estimate in the last 20 years that I've been doing this, I personally worked with about 2,000 people. And I could tell you story after story of people who, once they kind of figured out what that giftedness was and started to make choices on the basis of it, it's amazing. Opportunities start to open up that they wouldn't have thought about or considered. And, of course, I know that God's at work behind the scenes, because he wants you to get your giftedness in play.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we go back to Genesis 1. The very first words that God said to human beings after he created them were, be fruitful, multiply, fill the earth, and rule over it.
Mm-hmm.
God wants to make this world flourish. He wants to bring life to it. And the means that he's given us to make the world flourish is through the gifts that he's given us. And everybody adds value a little differently. Some people are gifted to the task of getting ore out of a mountain and turn it into metal. Somebody else is really gifted to the task of shaping and designing that metal into an automobile. Somebody else is gifted the task of laying out the highway it's going to run on. Somebody else is gifted the task of getting the oil out of the ground and turning it into gasoline to drive it. Somebody else gifted to the task of financing that, to educating all the workers, to taking care of their bodies when they get sick, and to attend to their spiritual needs so that they really connect with God. So God's given all these different gifts to us so that we would cause the world and its people to flourish. So God wants us to discover our gifts and get into paths that are fruitful for us.
So you've said that you are an impactor. What are some of the other categories of giftedness that we can be thinking about?
Well, in one sense, there's as many kinds of giftedness as there are human beings in the world. We serve an infinite God, and I like to say that God is what giftedness is what I call incarnational truth. You know, my view is that when God designs a human being, he takes some dimension of himself that he does in an infinite way, and he fashions a human being to do that exact same thing, only in a finite way. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it's a mystery to me, but for some reason we serve this God who delights in seeing himself in human form. Mm-hmm. So that when somebody does that thing that he's put in them to do, He delights in that because he sees a little picture of himself, and he's the only person anywhere that's worthy of his own delight.
Mm-hmm.
So in that sense, you know, theoretically, God could design an infinite number of human beings. But just to give you some examples, some people, they don't want to make an impact. They want to build things and develop things. Somebody else wants to understand something to a very deep level. Somebody else, it's all about gaining response from people and influencing their behavior. Then you have people that they can see potential and then exploit that potential. They often end up as entrepreneurs. You have people that love to plan and produce, often turn into great administrators because they can get the logistics and the operations functioning. And then you have the creative types we tend to call realize the concept. You know, they can get a vision in their mind and then bring it about, perhaps through a song or a movie or, you know, some other finished product. And it's just it's amazing to see people wake up to this unique thing that they have and how they go about doing it. I've never seen anybody break into tears over the results of their Myers-Briggs test, okay? But it's not unusual for people when I finally sort of confront them with the analysis, and here's what it really shows about you. They've lived that experience their whole life, but to have it kind of named mm-hmm. and celebrated, for many people it literally reforms their understanding of themselves in a very positive way.
And it gives them a fresh way to focus on what it is that they could and should be doing.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly.
So here I am. It's now the next question that I guess is a natural one might go something like this. So does everybody have to go through this kind of inventory to figure out their giftedness, or are there ways that you can kind of get the ball rolling?
Well, I've often thought about that because 1,000 years ago, you know, how did people learn about their giftedness, you know? I believe that before the fall, here's how it might have worked. You observe me doing something that's right out of my gift, and you recognize that, and you say to me, Bill, that was pretty amazing what you just did. Did you see the value of that? And I go, wow, I hadn't noticed, but thanks for pointing that out. And you look like you really enjoyed it. Your heart was in it. I go, yeah, that's true. My heart really was in it. And then either you or I are in a position to say, isn't it a wonderful thing that God made me that way?
Hmm.
And with enough feedback like that from people around us, we would each start to wake up to the thing that we offer and have it celebrated. Even after the fall, I believe that the first way and the most common way that people discover their gifts is they get feedback from other people and the environment. And, of course, much of that feedback is from parents, siblings, teachers, peers. And that's okay to a point, except that being fallen human beings, oftentimes that feedback gets couched in negative terms. And I can name the very thing that's true about you in terms of your gift, put a negative label on it. You know, like perfectionist. You know, anal retentive. I mean,
not exactly compliments.
No, but yeah, there is a kind of person who wants to get things right.
Right, exactly, and pays attention to details because details oftentimes do matter.
And so they kind of live with this sense of shame because it cannot not do that thing. But then they wonder, well, maybe I'm doing something wrong.
Yeah. So, and I take it that the other thing that's involved in thinking about giftedness is thinking about the varieties of ways in which people can mix and match so that there's not only the giftedness that you have, but when you're in a work environment, you're working alongside other people as well who almost certainly don't share the exact talents that you have, but who you need to mesh together with in order to make it work. So that's another dimension of the equation.
Well, that's the genius of the corporation and of frankly community in general. And it goes right back to the New Testament. We need all the gifts. We need all the gifts. And it flows out through society as well. It takes all kinds to make a world. There's all kinds of different work that needs to be done. And when you put those gifts together, the whole is much greater than just the sum of the parts. And you see that in corporations that do amazing things like build these jet airplanes or an iPad or, you know, whatever. Yes, the giftedness is profoundly powerful when you organize it well and deploy it well.
And so that giftedness that makes organizations work really has a whole other skill.
That's
correct. Because I've often heard CEOs say that besides representing the company, that one of their major responsibilities is to make sure people are in the right chairs.
Right.
I've often heard that figure a lot.
Yeah.
And what you're trying to say is that you're meshing together a variety of skills in a way that works effectively and efficiently for whoever it is that you're working for.
Yeah. And so some of my clients have been teams and organizations to help them figure that out.
Yeah, that's interesting. Well, let me go to another question that kind of strikes me as we talk, and that is, well, it's all nice and good to be able to walk into an office and ask someone to help me find my giftedness, but that seems to be aimed at a certain kind of person in a certain kind of society who has a certain kind of freedom and opportunity to do something. What about the average guy out there and particularly the people who don't live in a world as full of choice as some societies have?
Yeah, I get asked that question a lot. And I think it's basically the question, Bill, is giftedness just a luxury? And my answer is, oh, no, it's not a luxury. It's a reality. In other words, this is built into the nature of what it means to be a human being. The giftedness is there regardless of whether the environment favors its expression or not. So take the rice farmer in North Korea. You know, that person has had no education, probably. They're working a fairly menial job. They may be starving. They still have a giftedness. They still have a giftedness. It's in there. Nobody's bothered to kind of check out what it is. But what's fascinating is that giftedness is what we call irrepressible, which means you can't keep it down. It's like in a swimming pool with a bunch of ping pong balls. You know, you can try to keep them underwater, but sooner or later they're going to pop up. And giftedness is like that. And even in oppressive situations, giftedness will out itself. And so, you know, I think about, tribes out in the jungle or nomadic groups in the desert or whatever. You know, over time, people start to realize, you know, this person's exceptionally good at farming. Like their crops always seem to yield more. And meanwhile, this person over here is great at telling stories. And this lady over here is fantastic in cooking. You know, and this person here seems to have a knack for you know, helping you process the questions you're asking and just wise. And, you know, and so people slowly but surely sort of figure out what some of people's gifts are. Now, having said that, I'd also point out that in our Declaration of Independence, the founders they said that there are three inalienable rights, which means they're rights given by the Creator. You can't just do away with them. And they are, obviously, life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. So what they meant by the pursuit of happiness was to do life, to pursue life, in the paths that you felt God was leading you to do.
Mm-hmm.
And it's inherent, in order to pursue that, you have to have freedom. And you will notice around the world throughout history where people have been given freedom to educate and then to exercise their gifts, you have flourishing. Where those freedoms are not present, you tend to end up with automatons and people that in many ways are becoming less human.
Yeah, less humane environment, really.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And so, you know, not to get political about it, but I you know, very much believe that wherever we can in this world, we ought to be praying for and we ought to be working for, you know, people's freedom. I guess one other factor on this, Daryl, is until about 75 years ago, there wasn't really a need in the world to figure out people's giftedness, because prior to that, virtually all the work of the world was done on farms and factories. And in those economies, one strong back is as good as another. You can just plug and play people. But with the rise of knowledge work, you now discover that everybody adds value differently. And knowledge work is great because it accesses more of our personhood, and it gives more expression or possibilities for expression of that giftedness. Now, we're still, as I say, only 75 years into what amounts to a grand experiment. We still don't know very much about how to educate knowledge workers, how to position them for effectiveness, how to organize them and manage them, how to incentive them. We've just had endless experiments trying to figure this out as we go, and I think we're making a little bit of progress, but it's still very early in that transition. But it's profound to think that the nature of work fundamentally changed back there, and the locus of work moved from the land to the mind, and that affects the giftedness piece, because we really have to think about, well, how do you add value?
Mm-hmm. So you've got, I mean, another way to articulate this, I'd be interested to hear your reaction to this, is to say, you know, you had kind of your core agriculture and survival skills, kind of the core things of life that people used to do, or what we would perhaps refer to today technically as manufacturing kinds of jobs and that kind of thing. Now you have whole other areas. You said knowledge work, but I immediately leapt to, there are a whole group of services that people provide that aren't manufacturing.
Right.
They aren't knowledge work, okay, but they're service work. That's different. There's the whole realm, and certainly this has become big in our time, the whole realm of entertainment, that where a lot of people reside, and where the arts tend to get expressed, for example. Arts aren't, technically speaking, manufacturing. They're not services in one sense. So part of what I think you're suggesting is that when you move from kind of a basic subsistence level of life, with where you either are growing things or designing things, manufacturing things, to all these other characteristics and possibilities, you open up the field for how giftedness can express itself.
Absolutely. And this all goes back to Genesis 1. God wants the world to flourish. You know, the world on its own just gives us natural resources. Humans have to do something to transform those resources into something valuable. But it's a big world. And every day we start to see just how much more God has built into the potential of this world to make it flourish. You actually saw that at the Tower of Babel in Genesis, what is it, 9?
11.
Well.
Yeah.
It's back there.
Yeah.
But, you know, God says when these people build this tower, which is a fairly sophisticated project, you know, at this rate, there's nothing these people aren't going to be able to do. And he wasn't ready for them to do all that, you know, he had in mind. And so he confuses the languages and spreads them abroad. ironically, what we're sort of seeing nowadays with this global economy is people working back together again, you know, even internationally. And once again, you see these amazing sort of results and products out of that, and different kinds of work. And it makes me think a lot about what would happen if, as people did their work, they brought God back into their work. It wasn't just on their human strength, as impressive as that can be, but the whole way they did their work was directed toward this God who himself is a worker and has given him this work because, in fact, he wants the world to flourish. It would transform people's mindset about what they're doing.
So this brings in the faith and work dimension that ties into giftedness pretty effectively. And the interesting thing about that, it seems to me, is that I think when you talk to most people about faith and work, they say, okay, we're talking about how I can be a Christian at work or how I can do evangelism at work. They think of it in terms of
it's a platform.
Mission. Yeah. But really, you're talking about something much more basic, in some ways profound, in terms of the way people go about actually seeing their work as their vocation. We tend to think of ministry and vocation as happening only
in the church.
In the church with the pastor or in the Sunday school class or in children's church or with the choir. Okay, that's where I do ministry.
Correct.
So ministry's in the confined to these four walls. Meanwhile, the bulk of my week, okay, is kind of irrelevant.
Correct.
You know, or some people, well, I go and work so I can take care of my family and earn the money that I want to earn, and it ends up being directed either towards oneself or towards the things that I really care about.
Right.
That's another way to think about it. But you're really talking about something completely different, something far more, as I said, profound. Why don't you talk about what that difference is?
Well, a lot of it has to do with God cares about the work itself. The work itself, like if your job, Dorothy Sayers says, if your job is to make shoes, then you need to make the best shoes you can possibly make and do it to the glory of God. And really, what God's interested there is not just whether you're a good person. It's like, well, how good are the shoes? Because that's indeed what the work is fundamentally about. Mm-hmm. Have you added value to this world to, in some way, in your little corner, whatever God's put under your control, have you made that more life-giving? Have you made it flourish? Have you, frankly, treated it as though God himself were the steward over it? Because, in fact, he's put you in responsibility over that little piece of the world. It changes, then, sort of the spirit with which you do your work. And not just about, you know, you and your needs and so forth, but it's about the work itself.
So and we're back into Genesis 1 again, of course, where the exhortation, I call this the creation mandate, mm-hmm. is to be fruitful and multiply and manage the earth well. Or sometimes the metaphor is used, I think it's a good one, of managing the garden. You know, God placed us in a garden. It's the picture of Genesis 1 and 2. He placed us there as part of the creation to manage and to manage well. That management involves not only how we relate to the material world that God has placed us in, but also how we relate to each other, alongside each other. And so the core calling of a human being is to service the creation and service people within the creation well.
Right.
I can do that in all kinds of places in all kinds of ways.
That's right. And I can't stress, I mean, I'm preaching to the choir.
Right,
I mean,
right,
we talk
right.
about this stuff all the time.
Right.
But I can't stress enough for our audience how widespread is the view that work is kind of a curse or at best a necessary evil. And that the real work of God takes place within a church context. And I was on a cohort for a university online talking about giftedness. And I remember there was this woman from somewhere in Africa. And at the question and answer time, she said, "Now, Mr. Hendricks, let me see if I follow you here. I thought I heard you say that I could exercise my spiritual gifts outside the church. And I said, well, yes, that's in essence, you know, what I said. And there was a pause, and she said, I've never thought of that before. I'll have to reflect on that.
Mm-hmm.
And I just realized in that moment that she had just had this assumption about the nature of work and the nature of, you know, church work, and the two weren't to be confused. And it's as if God, you know, has put all this grace into us through his gifts, but we stay in the toolbox. We don't get out there and use it. It's like we're keeping all the goodies for ourselves and our churches, and meanwhile, there's a world that's starving for people who have a real purpose in life and are also committed to doing the best work they know how to do.
You know, the interesting thing about this is full of ironies, because when you do that, you create a divided world, you create a divided self. You also, I think, create a world in which the life, relevant life, is confined to this sacred space that we've created. And we've got this secular world out here. And actually what we've done, this is where the irony is, what we've done is we have created the world that a secularist wants us to create, in the sense of there's the everyday world out here that's not sacred, and then there's this sacred space which everyone can create in their own way, and let's keep it tight and sacred, you know.
And separate.
That's right, and separate. And yet I think what Scripture is calling for us to say is to say everywhere where God has his sacred people becomes sacred space. And they have the opportunity to live in a way that reflects the way God made them, his giftedness, his presence, and his sense of equipping us to serve one another and to work well together. Granted, this has all been tainted by what happens in the fall, but still, in terms of the design and the intent, that's the way things are supposed to be seen. So that when we move into our jobs and we do what God has called us to do, I often use this illustration a lot. I said, you know, think about what it takes for you to have your Wheaties in the morning.
Yeah.
All the steps of what it takes. And really,
all the different people.
All the different people. And I mean, and if you really think that through, you realize this is happening at all kinds of levels.
Correct.
I mean, it's from the person who grows the grain to the box that it goes in, to
all the
wrapper.
Transportation.
That's a whole nother level, the transportation.
All the financing.
What it took for the truck to be able to go from place
Oil
A to
and gas,
place B.
Transportation.
Exactly. The making of the roads. It's mind-blowing.
The education of the workers.
Exactly right.
The medical care for the workers.
What it takes to get that Wheaties, that little box of Wheaties in that bowl in front of you.
Pretty profound.
Myriads of people. Myriads of skills.
And I was in New York last week. So there's a city of, what is New York now, 10 million people? I don't know. It's millions of people.
Right, right.
And every day, food gets to those people.
Yeah.
And I just think that is an amazing thing that many people in such close, you know, proximity, their basic needs are met. The water, the food, you know, the transportation, let's not go there. But, you know, when we Christians tend to read our Bibles, it's almost like we put a set of glasses on that limit us to seeing and interpreting so many of the texts within this really narrow context. So, for instance, if you go to the New Testament and Paul says something like, you know, therefore be tenderhearted, forgiving one another as Christ has forgiven you. We tend to think, well, that means somebody in church I do that with. And we don't tend to think, no, that also includes the coworker that you're next to at work,
mm-hmm.
the customer, you know, that is hacked off, or it hasn't paid or whatever. I mean, we spiritualize these passages and therefore narrow them instead of saying, oh no, This is for all of our life. We take that into all of our life.
Now, there are a series of passages that drop in my head when you say this. I mean, there's a passage in Galatians 6 which says, do good to all, especially to those of the faith. Or I'm going to have some fun with the Good Samaritan. Jesus didn't tell the Good Samaritan story and say, well, first check out and see if they're a member of your local church and then help them. Right. You know, he said, go and be a neighbor, that kind of thing. And in telling the story about the Samaritan, he's also making another point, and that is, and neighbors may come in surprising packages and packages that may surprise you. In fact, when he describes the Samaritan as a good neighbor, and he asks the lawyer who he's telling the parable to, you know, who proved to be the neighbor to the one who fell among the thieves, the guy is so traumatized by the example, he doesn't say, you know, the Samaritan, you know, he says the one who showed mercy. He can't even say it. So there's this idea of how we serve other people made in the image of God in a caring that extends, you know, without boundaries in such a way that we show who we are. The third passage that's in my head is a very famous passage. It's the passage in Jeremiah where the call is to exiles, Jewish exiles who are in Babylon, not exactly the most friendly and spiritual place in the history of mankind. And the exhortation is serve the city.
Right.
Seek the peace of the city. And so they're told to live their everyday lives in such a way that their life is a testimony to the power, presence, and effectiveness, and goodness, and grace, and kindness of God.
And praise God, here and there, and I'd say on an increasing basis, but it's slow, you will see individuals who are in positions of leadership in companies and businesses and so forth, who are really catching that vision, and they're literally creating their business into a model of how you do that in very practical ways, whether it's by how they grow food, you know, in a real green way, and this is happening a lot overseas where through microloans and so forth, you get a group of people, and they need work, and you bring them together, you provide some means, and you start to see the giftedness show up, and so you build up that business into something that then is a resource for the community, and it's exciting to me to see what have traditionally been called lay people, you know, not the paid professionals, but people in everyday work catch a vision for how they could use the systems that God has put under their control to actually bring that flourishing about.
You know,
the work.
It's interesting. The managers in businesses who get this, who come out of a Christian background and think about how do I make my work, you know, my vocation, how do I see it as ministry, will say things to me like, I view the people that I manage as my flock.
Right.
You know, they'll take what is traditionally church language and church attitudes and church pictures of shepherding and caring and protecting and providing, all those kinds of things, and they'll move it over into their job, and they'll say, that's how I view my people. I don't view my people as chess people pieces to move around on a board in order that
commodities.
Yeah, commodities. But I really am thinking about how to care and develop them as people as they do what they do, interact with them in such a way that it's effective.
Yeah, I believe every manager is in a position to literally affect the spiritual, the soul, I would say, of people that work for them. And you think, well, how can they do that? Because how you set up the work and how you oversee the work and how you reward the work, all of that affects the person's outlook on life. And if they hate their work, they take that home and it poisons the whole home. Whereas if you set up the work to be, again, life-giving, so they feel like, oh, I belong here, I can express the best of who I am, I can make a contribution, well, now their work means something. They take that home and it permeates their whole community.
So there's a sense in which there's a, also a soul of a corporation that gets created as a result.
Exactly.
Yeah.
A company can affect its community. Frankly, it can affect a whole region. It can affect a whole nation.
Yeah, and so this area has fascinated me ever since I've gotten into it, and the myriads of ways in which it works. But the core thing is when people understand that what they do matters, and most jobs that people have do matter in one way or another. They do contribute to the cycle. They allow me to eat my Wheaties, you know, every day. I get my food every day, or you know, or the clothes on my back, or whatever. They do perform a real service, and when people see that contribution and they're doing it out of a skill set that God's been giving them, then their life is a more
life profoundly. Makes sense.
That's right. Life makes sense. So we thank you for coming in and being a part
Thanks.
Of this and discussing.
Thanks for having me.
Glad to do it. And we're glad you could be with us on the table, and we look forward to seeing you back again with us soon.
Thanks for listening to The Table Podcast. For more podcasts like this one, visit dts.edu/thetable. Dallas Theological Seminary. Teach truth, love well.